I'm David Reynolds. I was asked to introduce and talk to Steve on stage about his book by the Stanford's Travel Writers Festival people. And I was greatly honored and pleased to do that. But I hadn't read the book, and I thought, well, I hope I'm going to like it. And I've read it the last couple of weeks, and I can tell you in all honesty, I'm not only here because they asked me to be, but I'm very pleased that the book is such a great book. Steve really attacks this subject of the gold rush and the modern contemporary gold rush in three ways. He tells you the history in a very palatable way, and he'll tell you more about that. He gives you a little bit of science, but not too much, about what gold is, and it's easily intelligible by people like me. Just a little bit of that. And then the rest of it, which is wonderful, is his own experience. And he'll tell you in a minute why he did this. He went there a couple of years ago?
Or yep.
2013, was it?
2013.
Right. Where there is a bit of a gold rush going on, he'll tell you. And he experienced all this stuff himself. And he actually changes as a person in the book, which is, I think, a mark of a really good travel writer. It's not just what he sees and does, but it's also about him. And you get to like him, I can tell you that. But he's not perfect, and he's very honest and self-deprecating and modest and funny about himself, but also some of it is very moving, because he meets some fascinating people with whom he gets quite, to some of whom he gets quite close, and it's very uplifting. So I really recommend the book, but I'm going to ask Steve now to tell us, can you hear me all right, by the way? Yeah? Sounds very strange from where I am. I'm going to ask him to tell us why you did it, really. That's the first thing.
It started off really by accident. When in 2008, actually March the 13th, 2008, the price of gold went through $1,000 an ounce for the first time. It was March the 13th. And there was something psychological about that figure. And also in 2008, of course, it was the recession. A lot of people were losing their jobs, particularly in America. And all of a sudden they saw that, you know, they could dig gold out of the ground and get $1,000 an ounce for it. What could possibly go wrong? So a lot of people headed for the hills, and they did literally start buying mining equipment. An awful lot of them had no idea how to use it. They went to rivers and they started digging for gold. They still have, what do we call them, mining claims in America. You can still, it's like the old movies. You know where you make a claim, and the films you saw with Red Buttons and Audie Murphy shooting each other over a claim, they still have those. And the number of claim applications went up by 20% in just 12 months. So I'm a journalist by day, and I persuaded a magazine to send me out there and go and have a look at this new gold rush. So I get out there, and sure enough, there are all of these people, an awful lot of sad cases, to tell you the truth, who were digging for gold in the hope that they would strike it rich. Because the irony is, I take it you've all heard of the 1849 California gold rush. We've probably heard of that. Well, that involved approximately 350,000 people going looking for gold. In spite of the best efforts of all those people, they found less than 20% of the gold in California that geologists estimate is in the ground. So, of course, that gives everybody great hope. All that gold's still in the ground. You know, why can't I have some? And as recently as last year, a guy found a 5-pound nugget, which he sold at auction for $400,000.
So how big is that? Just tell us.
A 5-pound nugget is probably about that big, I would guess.
Like a cricket ball?
Probably smaller than a cricket ball. Probably smaller. It's very, very dense gold. Very, very heavy.
Okay, thank you.
So every now and then when those finds turn up, it just fuels this craziness. People think, well, that guy found a 5-pound nugget, and he sold it for $400,000. And they think, well, I could do that too. So people do it. So I went and covered this story for a magazine. And I thought the people who were doing it were a bit crazy. you know, I'd say to them, you know, how much gold have you got? And they'd go, come with me. And they'd take me to their tent. And then they'd have a case, and they'd unlock the case. And inside the case, they'd have some gold. And I'd say, well, how come you've got this gold? What, you know, why haven't you sold it? Because 10 minutes earlier, they'd be telling me that they were poor and that they'd left the wife and kids at home to struggle and fend for themselves. And I'd say, well, how come you've still got that gold? And they couldn't bring themselves to sell it. They'd just fallen in love with the gold. They had gold fever. So I came back, I wrote my article, but I sort of kept half an eye on the price of gold. Because I secretly, I quite fancied having a go. You know, I think I got the bug. You know, that sort of element of, well, if they're doing it, you know, why can't I? So I kept my eye on the price of gold, which in 2008, as we said, was $1,000 an ounce. It had taken 6,000 years since the pharaohs started digging for gold for it to reach $1,000 an ounce. 3 years later, it was on the cusp of $2,000 an ounce. So it had taken 6,000 years to reach $1,000 an ounce and three more years for that to double. And at that time, I made myself a little promise. I didn't tell anybody because it was a bit bonkers if the truth's known. But I told myself that when the price of gold reached $2,000 an ounce, I'd go and I'd have a go. I'd go digging for it. See if I couldn't do it, you know? And I didn't tell anybody, and I don't mind telling you that my wife's in the audience there, and I didn't tell her either. Long-suffering Suzanne. So it rose to $1,920 an ounce. And all of the big banks were saying it would go through the $2,000 an ounce barrier in 2013. But it didn't. It fell. The price fell, and it's still falling. So by July of 2013, it had fallen to $1,220 an ounce. And I was really disappointed because I'd sort of abdicated the right to sort of make a choice about going looking for gold. I was just going to leave it to the markets. If the markets drove it to $2,000 an ounce, then it wasn't my fault. I was just going to go. But it didn't reach that. And I was so disappointed. I was more disappointed than I imagined, you know, I possibly could be. And so I thought, oh, what the heck, I'm going to go anyway. So I broke the news to Suzanne, and I jumped on a plane, and I went to California. I flew to San Francisco, and I had not a clue. Didn't know how to find gold, didn't know where to look, didn't know how to get it out of the ground, didn't know how to pan. But I went to San Francisco, and then I drove 2.5 hours inland to the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which is where the original gold rush was. And I decided, you know, it's all or nothing. Here we go. So that's how I found myself in America. And you'll notice that I didn't blame myself for any of this stupidity at any point. And I think that's what gold fever is. You abdicate all responsibility for the things that are going to happen to you next.
Okay, so that's how you got started.
Yeah.
And then you met lots of people.
Yep.
And one thing that happened was that the group of people you got friendly with told you how dangerous wandering around in the brush or around rivers and things looking for gold, how dangerous that is. And there's a little bit in the book that I rather like that... Maybe you
about
could read
the
about the yeah about yeah. bears and all that kind of. I think we should have a little read, just okay. to see about the great prose this man writes, which he does.
Well, to put this into context, already being an idiot, I've gone to the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and when I get there, people are saying to me, "Nah, you're in the wrong place. You need to be 300 miles away." So it's 300 miles north into arguably the most isolated part of the United States of America. Millions and millions of acres of beautiful mountains and forests with hardly any roads. And I'd met people who were up there prospecting for gold. Two of them, named Dave and Rich, had promised that they would take me out with them on this one day. And I didn't believe them. I thought they'd give me the slip. But I went out to wait for them in my car. And I remember that the previous night, three campers that I'd met told me all about the dangers of being in that part of the world and looking for gold. Okay. So I was waiting for these guys and wondering what would happen next. Would you mind if I stand up?
No, I
read better standing up. I don't know why. Okay. All I knew was that we would be going downriver, probably to some isolated spot far from any other human presence. The night before, around my makeshift table, I'd asked Terry, Craig, and Tom what I needed to know about the wilderness. What did I need to look out for? Bears, I was thinking. I'd been confused for some time about how best to handle bears. Should you stand up and make yourself big when confronted by a grizzly? No, that was what you did with the brown bear. Or maybe that was a black bear. You should run downhill. They can't run downhill because of their short hind legs. Or was it uphill? Yes, that's what you did with the black bear. Or you should climb a tree. At least one species of bear can't climb a tree. But which one was it? And with a brown bear, you lie down and pretend to be dead until it loses interest. Or was that what you did with a grizzly? No, you jumped into the river and swam. They're not very good swimmers. Or were they excellent swimmers? I couldn't remember. The truth was, I had no idea. And the thought of confronting something with claws and fangs that weighed considerably more than a tumble dryer filled me with terror. The three men looked at one another. If you see a bear, best thing is maybe wave and take a picture, said Terry. They laughed. I maintained the utmost seriousness. Honestly, said Craig, you probably won't see one. And if you do, you'll be lucky. It will most likely be on the other side of the river, and it won't be interested in you. They don't eat people. They hide from people. Unless it's a mother with her cubs. If you get anywhere near those cubs, or between the mother and the cubs, she'll rip you to pieces. Nah, you're more likely to be attacked by a mountain lion than by a bear, Tom had said. That's still pretty unlikely, but they have been known to kill people. Nope, said Terry. Rattlesnakes. It's them you should be worried about. Get a good stick and hit the ground in front of you. Don't take one of those guys by surprise. If he hears you coming, he'll get his tail up and start rattling, and you can back off slowly. You get bitten out there and don't get help, you could die. The others had nodded sagely for a few moments before Craig broke the silence. Well, that's true, but it's poison oak that's really going to get you. It's everywhere, and it itches like a bitch if you touch it. Sometimes blisters, too. It won't kill you, but boy, will it ruin your week. You know what poison oak looks like? I shook my head. It has three leaves like this, he said, spreading out the three middle fingers on his right hand. You better learn to spot poison oak. For a few moments while I added this to my list of fears, all I could hear was the sound of cicadas and my unsteady breathing. Dehydration, said Terry suddenly. Tom and Craig looked up and nodded. People get carried away in the heat. Work too hard, you're losing fluid all the time, and if you don't replace it, you pass out. If there's no one there to help you, you're a goner. I looked at my feet and took a deep breath. Water, I thought. Always water. Never be without water, and don't take any chances. And salt, you'll need that. And a stick, and maybe a gun. Ticks, said Tom suddenly, with a shiver. Everyone turned in his direction. That's what scares me most. They hang on trees and wait for you to pass by. Then they drop on you and burrow under your skin, sucking your blood. If you don't spot them on your body, before you know it, you've got Lyme's disease. And that can go to your joints, your heart, your brain. Craig and Terry nodded, pulling faces. I swallowed hard. Tarantulas, began Craig. I was staring up at the mountains, wondering whether I was actually ready to go into the wilderness. When Rich and Dave Mack, when I was shaken by the honk of a horn. They weren't trying to give me the slip. They were slowing down and gesturing me to follow them. For a fraction of a second, as they overtook and led me to Highway 96, our cars were parallel. And before I was blinded by the sun, I saw the silhouette of two men with their mouths open, as if yawning or laughing. I couldn't be sure which. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. That's very good. Now, you've written quite a bit about the history of the thing.
Yes.
About the 49ers, mm-hmm. and how these people trekked across America. Mm-hmm. You particularly focus on three people.
Yes.
And I found that a particularly good bit of the book, all that. And he's very good at editing his own writing and intercutting his own story with the stories of these people 150 years ago, whatever. Could you tell us something about those three people?
Sure.
Particularly maybe well, it's up to you, but Sarah Royce appealed to me a lot, I must say, this woman who went on the gold rush.
Yeah, Sarah was originally born in Stratford-upon-Avon in England, and she was taken to Iowa as a little baby by her parents. And she married a farmer when she grew up, and they had a baby. And then in 1848, gold was discovered in California. Now, from where they lived, it was approximately 2,500 to 3,000 miles away. It was a long way away. But gold had been discovered in January 1848. The news took almost a year to filter across the country. But when it did, people like Sarah's husband, who was called Josiah, they got the bug. They were hearing reports of people literally picking gold up off the floor. And they were in the early days. So he announced to Sarah that they were going to travel to California. It was an incredible journey. I mean, at that time, not many people had traveled very far west. They'd gotten as far west as Oregon. Very few people had made it into California because there are these natural barriers of deserts and mountains. The Sierra Nevada mountain range has somewhere in the region of 500 mountains over 12,000 feet. So that's about half the height of Mount Everest. So it's not many people had made it there. People had blazed the trail to Oregon, farmers, but getting into California was something different. Very few people had done that. So when the gold rush started, it was almost universally men who did it. Sarah was one of very, very few women who did it. And it was arduous in the extreme. I mean, can you imagine going across countryside and mountains and deserts? No roads, no shops, no bridges. You know, if you had to ford a river, you had to build a raft, you know? And she was an amazing woman. You know, she didn't complain about anything. She knuckled down and she did it. And I found, I developed the utmost respect for her. You know, we've heard of true grit in the American West.
Yeah.
But I think she was the nearest thing I've ever...
And she did all that with a small child.
With a two-year-old child.
And then there's a very dramatic bit.
Yes.
They're kind of a bit late in the year, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, that's right. Well, basically,
and they meet a woman who gets them rescued
that,
by...
Yeah, that's right.
Just that bit. It's very exciting.
Yep.
The soldiers.
That's right.
Yeah.
There are various landmarks along the route, usually in the form of rocks. And there's a rock called Independence Rock. And the travelers across the states... called it Independence Rock, because if you didn't make it to that rock by the 4th of July, Independence Day, you probably wouldn't make it over the Sierra Nevada mountains, because they got snowed in, and you would just simply die. They went past Independence Rock 2 weeks late. So it was touch and go whether they were going to make it over the mountains once they reached the border with California. But even before then, they had to get across a desert. It's called 40 Mile Desert. And in order to get across that desert, you had to make sure that your oxen, people chose oxen over horses, that they were tougher. Yeah. You had to make sure that they were well-watered, well-fed, or they just wouldn't make it across the mountains. Sarah and Josiah had stopped in Salt Lake City, you know, which had only recently been established by the Mormons. And somebody had sold them a map, just a map written on an old piece of paper. And they put their lives... They entrusted their lives on the strength of the instructions on this map. And the guy who sold it to them said that the previous year he'd met some people who were coming back the other way. And he said, they should be here about now. And if you meet them, they'll tell you where you can get water for your horse, for your oxen. I mean, this sounds crazy, doesn't it? You know, you're putting your life and the life of your baby and your husband in the hands of some geezer you've met in Salt Lake City who just drew you a map. Anyway, the map said that they had to go slightly into the desert and then there'd be a path going off where there would be some water. And they believed him. Off they went, and they missed the turnoff. They found themselves miles and miles into the desert and they had to make a decision, do they go on or do they go back? And this is after 6 months of traveling. Do they go back? They made the decision to go back. And on their way back, they encountered some other people who had spent the night at the very watering hole that they'd missed. These people told them where to find the water, and they went all the way back. And they did stay there for 24 hours, watered the oxen, filled everything they owned with water. And they made it across the desert. but the snows were coming in once they reached the mountains. They never would have made it. And then in front of them, they saw some dust, and it was two men on horses pulling behind them some mules. And the people they'd bumped into in the desert had in turn been rescued by these men who'd been sent out by the US Army and had actually said, you've got to go back for this woman and her baby because they'll never make it back alone. And one of these men had a baby the same age as Sarah's baby. And on the strength of that, and on the strength of that only, he went further than his orders allowed him to go, and he met them. That chance meeting in the desert with that woman and this woman's insistence during her chance meeting with these soldiers saved Sarah's life. They led them over the mountains to safety when lots and lots, I'm talking thousands of people, were dying, you know? And they made it to safety because of that one chance meeting in the desert.
Yeah. It's incredibly moving, that bit. And then Sarah wrote a book all about it herself, which I haven't read, but he has, and it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think we should move forward to you now again.
My son.
How did you feel when you found it? Tell us about when you found gold.
Okay. So first of all, would it be useful to actually explain how you find gold? Is that the sort of thing? Okay. The reason why I mentioned rivers earlier on, and the reason why gold was initially found in California in a river, the American River, is because it exists as a result of thermal action, tectonic movement. It gets forced up in molten form up through sort of, because of geological forces, up into mountains. And over millions and millions of years, it settles in quartz inside mountains. And then as the mountains are eroded by weather and glaciers and so on, the gold is freed. Now, because it's so heavy, it just keeps falling and falling and falling as it gets washed down. And, of course, the lowest place that water falls down to, and which is what washes the gold down, of course, are rivers. Gold is 19 times heavier than water, and it's 8 times heavier than anything else you'll find in a river. And so if you want to look for gold, that's where you look, in the river, on the riverbed. So what usually happens is that people will wait for sort of the summer when the rivers are low, and where the rivers were, usually where there had been floods the previous year, gold would have been carried, and once you dig down to bedrock, that's where you'll find the gold, okay? So that's why people head for rivers, okay? And that's where I went. So people were giving me advice on how to find gold, and you pan for it, you know, you dig for it, then you grade it down, and you grade it down smaller, and then you end up with a bucket full of what you call concentrates, and in those concentrates are going to be your deposits of gold, and it's going to be the heaviest thing in the bucket. So you know, you've seen on TV when they empty the dirt into the pan, and they wash the pan layer by layer, and they shake it. Well, the reason for that is that as you shake it, the gold falls to the bottom. So as you wash it away, you can do this in the sure knowledge that you're not going to wash the gold away. It's at the bottom. So you do this, and I did it. And when I got my first gold, I'd been working for about 6 hours. I dug a great big hole somewhere where there was evidence of a big flood about 20 years earlier. And I had blisters on my hands, my knees were raw, and I got nothing. All day, I got nothing. And then in the last pan from the last bucket, probably obviously because it's heavy, I washed and washed and washed, and all of a sudden, there was just one little sparkling, shiny piece of metal, and it was gold. And I honestly, I can try, there's a passage where I try to explain what it feels like when you first see gold, okay? I'll read that. And it's only short, okay? So, when you first see gold in a pan, your guts are rearranged and they never right themselves. Your heart presses urgently inside your chest. Your breathing quickens. You wonder how a person could ever be taken in by fool's gold, because there is nothing, nothing you can imagine like the sight of gold in a pan. For 4 billion years, the shining object winking at you now has existed unseen, First as molten metal deep inside the Earth's mantle. Then as the spew of tectonic convulsion from geothermic spasm, forced, pushed relentlessly ever closer to the surface to cool and be locked in petrified quartz veins, hidden for millennia and then undone by glacier and weather and water until finally washed clear and pulled down, down, down by gravity to the deepest place it could find, here, in this river, under this boulder, and into your pan. And it really feels different. You know, it takes you. When you first see it, you want some more. And that's gold fever. The definition of gold fever is a mania for seeking gold. And you would think that when people have a problem, you know, they find it difficult to admit to their problem. Everybody I met who was looking for gold was more than happy to admit they had gold fever. They said, sure, I want it, I want it, I want more. And they were hooked, but they were happy to admit they were hooked, you know.
Steve, tell us about, this is connected to that. There's a character in the book.
Dave Mack.
Called The Guy.
Oh, The Guy, yeah, yeah.
Who comes in at the beginning and...
Yeah.
Not again. And
everywhere, if ever you decide to do this, and honestly, I heartily recommend it. An awful lot in America just do it for fun. You know, a lot more do it for a living, but mostly it's just for fun. But everywhere you go, somebody will say to you every day, "Hey, did you hear about the guy on the Bear River? You know, in Mariposa, in Nevada City, you know, who found a nugget this big? Guys pulling nuggets out every day." And I heard about this guy hundreds of times. You know, "Hey, did you hear about the guy who did this? The guy who found that?" And it's always the guy. The guy's always found this. Guy's found that. I actually made a point of following these reports from time to time. And someone would say, "Yeah, it's, you know, in Happy Camp or in Mariposa or, you know, in Angel's Camp or, you know, Sutter's Creek." And I would go and ask around. The guy never existed. The guy never existed. He was a figment of everybody's imagination. You know, the guy was actually the guy they wished they could be. And then there was one day when I'd gone to a mine called Empire Mine outside Grass Valley in California to go and have a look at what was California's most productive underground mine for gold. It had been operating for 106 years. Tens of thousands of men, and it was pretty much universally men, had been digging there for 106 years. They dug 367 miles of tunnels to a depth of over 10,000 feet. And all of the gold that they found during that 106 years, it was massively profitable. It fueled enough economic activity to feed tens of thousands of families, to bring in a massive profit, to pay for research, development, all the latest mining tools for 106 years. And I was standing outside the mine looking at this frame. It was a steel frame. I couldn't figure out what it was for. It was 7 feet by 7 feet by 7 feet. All of the gold that they found in 106 years would fit inside that cube. And that gives you some idea of the value of gold. Something that compact, think about it, 7 feet, you know, what's that? Right? Something this compact could fuel that much economic activity for 106 years. So I was standing looking at this, and one of the rangers saw me there, and he took me around the museum. It was a museum now. And while I was there, I got talking to this couple. And the guy was a gold miner. You know, he had been when he was younger. Unfortunately, he had Alzheimer's at the time I met him. But he could remember all the stories about when he went prospecting with his dad. And as he told me more and more about what he'd actually done, I became more and more astonished. This guy and his father used to find 30 ounces of gold during a season. Now, if you imagine what an ounce of gold is worth, that's an awful lot of money. I never found anybody who had ever found that much gold. And then he told me that in the course of 24 hours, 1 year, he found 9 ounces of gold. So you imagine that today, that well, at the time, it would have been worth $18,000 he found in 1 day. And all of a sudden it dawned on me, this was the guy. This was him. And so the next day, this was very bad of me, and I hold up my hands. I look back now and I cringe a little bit. This guy had Alzheimer's. And 30 years previously, he'd found 9 ounces of gold in a single day. And I asked him if he could try and find that spot where he found those 9 ounces. The guy had Alzheimer's. In my own mind, I dressed this up that I was doing him a favor because he couldn't get out into the wilderness anymore. And he wanted to. So I dressed it up as if I was doing him a favor. But, you know, I wanted gold, didn't I? I was hoping that his luck would rub off on me. And the next day we went. The spot he took me to was one of the most isolated spots I've ever been to on Earth. I mean, it was 2 miles down into a canyon at a spot where quite clearly nobody had been for years and years and years. But on the way there, he kept getting lost, at which point I began to feel pretty disgusted.
As Greece endures an economic crisis, tourism is one of the few industries keeping the country afloat. Tourism accounts for...
There'd be an old piece of machinery or something. He said, that's me, I did that.
With
put a hoist up, and moved that rock out of the way, and I found some gold.
Turbans in
all over there.
On this first leg of my journey, I'll be visiting some of Greece's glorious islands before heading to the ancient capital Athens. I'll discover how some islanders made their fortunes.
Look at them, they look disgusting.
I'll see a side to Crete that's normally hidden.
All right, so this is a traditional greeting. It's okay.
And in Athens, I come face to face with the fury of a betrayed generation.
Can we have some with the video I said? You understand this? Yes or no?
It's called something else, is it?
Well, I called it a picker.
And what do you do with it?
Well,
or how does it make you feel, and then what do you do with it?
Okay, so mostly when you go looking for gold, you just find little tiny flakes. They're minuscule, and you know they look great, and they sparkle beautifully, and you know they don't weigh very much. On fewer, well, you're even less likely than that. You find what's called a picker. And this is something that literally you can probably get between the fingers of, you know, and that's why they call it a picker. And then occasionally get something bigger, and that's a nugget. Everybody wants nuggets, and it stands to reason. Well, there was one day, the only day I spent 2 months looking for gold. I looked on about 8 rivers, in about 10 different locations, low down, high up, and everything in between. And I found one piece of gold that I described as a picker, but I was working with a guy at the time. My partner was a guy called Bear River Gary. And the reason for that was that he used to prospect on the Bear River and his name was Gary. He said, no, that's a nugget. That's a nugget, you've got a nugget. I went, no. He said, that's a nugget. So that night I took it home and I hadn't looked at my gold for ages, but I got my gold out and I spread it out. And you do. I actually reached the point where I recognized them. I had names for some of the flakes. And there's this beautiful object. It was gold, and he was right. It was a nugget, you know? It's nice. And I was really pleased about that. But it was kind of my last night. I decided I was going to go home, you know? I'd done this for too long. So I gave it the next day. I gave it to Gary because he had a strange relationship. He was living with a woman who used to be his partner, but they were no longer partners anymore. She had 2 children from a previous marriage, and he loved those children, but he was going to have to leave, and he decided to make some jewelry for them. So I gave him the nugget, which incidentally, I didn't tell you this, incidentally, Suzanne and I got married last year, and on honeymoon we went back to gold country, and we met Bear River Gary. I introduced Suzanne to Bear River Gary, and he showed me a photograph of a piece of jewelry he had made that was round his, you know, stepdaughter's neck. So he was as good as his word, and that was the only decent piece of gold I found. But I think he put it to better use than I would have done.
Yeah.
That was nice, yeah. So if you can give gold away, you've pretty much got rid of your gold fever, I think, once you can give it away.
Yeah. So the book ends in this very moving, upbeat way.
Don't give the ending
away. Actually, at that point, you're slightly fed up with the whole thing. Although you've been telling me today you'd like to go back and...
I'd go back tomorrow. Yeah. Honestly, I couldn't recommend it enough. And if ever you go on holiday to California, drive up there. There's a road. And, of course, it's called Highway 49. What else is it going to be? Highway 49, and it winds beautifully from the northernmost reaches of the Sierra Nevada Mountains right the way down toward to a place called Mariposa, which, if you go any further south, you'll start to hit the Mojave Desert down there. And it's 293 miles long. And there's some beautiful towns on it. There's lots of old gold rush architecture, still survives, and great restaurants and nice bars and wonderful people. 293 miles is just the right length for a nice road trip. Can't recommend it highly enough.
Okay, Steve, I think we're running out of time, but we want to ask if anyone has any questions, please, for Steve. Yes, sir. Can you wait for the microphone? There we go.
Hi, sorry. You mentioned earlier about fool's gold. What is it, please?
Fool's gold is iron pyrites. They are very, very shiny, and you often see them on the bed of a river. They're very deceptive, and they shine beautifully, and they really get you a flutter. But if you pick it up, it just crumbles. It's easy to spot fool's gold, but the problem with it is that by the time you've taken the trouble to go in the water and dig it up and find it, you've already made a fool of yourself. Because real gold doesn't rest on the surface of the riverbed anyway. It's at the bottom, because it's heavy. So you're a bit of a fool anyway for picking it up, you know? But that's what it is, and it crumbles to the touch. It does not shine beautifully, though.
Okay. Any more questions?
Yeah. There's a lot of... people are saying there's a lot of shenanigans going on in the gold market. And some people question if American reserves have the 8,000 tons. And I understand that Germany, the United States was storing German's gold, the gold of Germany, and Germany want to repatriate it. And the Americans are taking years and years and years to repatriate it. It's like they don't have the gold anymore. Uh-huh. What's your comments on that?
Well, I didn't look into that aspect of gold. But the one thing you've hit on there, you're actually asking whether the Americans have stolen German gold. What I looked at the time was, you know, the way gold, the dollar and everything was tied to gold, the gold standard, we all used that, yeah? Well, there definitely was, back in the day, before they abandoned the gold standard in the 70s, they definitely didn't have enough gold to back up the currency back then. Everybody knew it. Nobody said anything because the whole world economy would collapse. So if you're asking me, have they got form for that kind of thing? Yeah, I guess so. But whether they'd steal German gold, I don't know. I don't know. You'd have to ask the Americans.
One quick question. Yeah. That highway, the 49, can you cycle it or is it just for cars?
Yeah, you can. It's like that. But yeah, you can. It would, if you're fit enough, it would be the most beautiful. Because it's not interstate highways. It's little windy roads, you know. It's just heartbreakingly beautiful. But if you'd have to be good at going uphill. You'd need that.
Steve, is it a coincidence that the road...
Sorry?
Is it a coincidence that the road through the gold country is Route 49?
It's named after the 49ers.
Oh, they deliberately called it that.
The 49ers, of course, were the people who rushed to the gold fields in 1849. So, it's appropriately named the 49.
They had the intelligence to name the road after the area.
They built the road first before the gold rush.
I thought it might be a coincidence. Good.
It's beautiful. If ever you get the chance to do it, it's staggeringly beautiful. 293 miles is perfect for a road trip. It's not exhausting, and there are some just such beautiful old gold rush towns, and a lot of the architecture still survives. And of course, it being California, there's lots of lovely food there as well, if that's your thing too, you know. And lots of microbreweries as well, if that's your thing, you know. Yeah. and good Californian wine too.
Any more questions, please?
Can I ask, because I'm quite intrigued, you seem very fond of it, you speak very emotionally about it, very with fond memories of it. Do you want to go back?
I would go back tomorrow. I'm sorry. very few people make a living out of it. Very, very few people. There's actually a disproportionate number of older people do this because they've already retired. They've provided for their old age. And a lot of people I met, you know, they surprised me with their age. Fit as fiddles. And they said, look, I can sit and watch daytime TV all day, or I can jump in a river and dig for gold in this beautiful scenery. I mean, one of the guys, oh, Bear River Gary. Bear River Gary actually had a miniature defibrillator in his heart because he'd had four heart attacks. And he discovered digging for gold about 4 years earlier. And at first, you know, his partner was terrified because he was going off to these isolated spots with a defibrillator in his heart. He'd had four heart attacks. And of course, if he had a heart attack up there, nobody would ever get to find out. Nobody would find him, you know. Anyway, when I met him, he'd lost, I think it was somewhere in the region of 5 stones. He was fit as a fiddle, and his doctor kept saying to him, look, I don't know what you're doing, but just keep doing it. So he didn't make enough to live on. But, you know, his future was provided for. He did this for fun. And I met people who were recovering from cancer. Lots of people who were recovering from depression. I met one guy who was paralyzed from the waist down. He regained some use in one leg, just enough to half bear his weight with some crutches. And every day he had a car that had been modified so he could just drive it with his hands. And he used to drive down to a river, get on his crutches, climb to the back of the car, get his equipment out, which he had on a rack. He'd put this rack on, and he would go, he would trek about a quarter of a mile to the river, and he'd sit in the river and he'd pan for gold. And this guy said his balance had improved. He'd been suicidally depressed, and he was feeling better about the world. Everybody I met who did this, just they were upbeat. You know, they gained something from it. And I've got to be honest, so did I. You know, it gave me a whole new outlook on life. And you know, when I reach a point where maybe it'd be time to slow down a little bit, I can't think of anything better than to head for the hills and go look for gold again.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Steve. And the whole story of how Steve did it and the history and so on, brilliantly written and integrated into this book, is available somewhere near here.
Yeah, where
over
is
there.
It? Oh, over there.
Over there.
Yes. I'll be signing later. Copies in a minute if anybody wants one.
So thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks, David.